So, what's the weather like in your future holiday?
Oh, it's been incredible. Blazing hot sunshine. Who could have seen this mid-September heat wave coming our way? It's been incredible. How about with you?
I don't know. I imagine cold, snow, and also strangely lots of midges. I'm not sure.
Well, that sounds perfect.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 255 of the Midfaith Crisis podcast. My name is Future Nick Page, and there is Future Joe Davis.
Hello from the future.
Yes, and we're recording this in advance because we're actually both on a holiday break.
Yes.
And so we're not going to do any How Are Yous, we're not going to do any church notices.
No.
We're just going to play you an interview that Joe has done with our mutual friend, Ali. Joe, set this up for us.
Okay, so, well, Dr. Alison Mayle is a very dear friend of ours. She is also a consultant geneticist, and she is also a trainer in the Enneagram. And I wanted to scratch beneath the surface of the Enneagram. I think I've said many times, I've found this so helpful, perhaps one of the most helpful tools I've ever found on sort of understanding myself and other people, really. So we wanted to really get inside the Enneagram, what it was. So Ali is going to take us on a bit of a whistle-stop tour around the nine types of the Enneagram. There's so much more to say. It was very difficult to keep this interview short. So apologies, it is a little bit longer than normal podcast, but I think it is worth listening to, and I hope you will be able to relate to much of what's said in this. So all I will just say quickly is that I was testing out new microphones that actually clip into the iPhone. But sorry for that. Hope it doesn't distract, and enjoy. Well, I am delighted to say that I am here with my very dear friend, Dr. Alison Mayle. Hello, Alison.
Hello. Hello, Reverend Davis.
We've just worked out we've been friends for 35 years, and it only seems like 34. So, it's so great to have you here. You and Dave have been dear friends of ours. We have holidayed together for most years, for most of those 35 years.
We have indeed, yeah.
But for those that don't know, just tell us a little bit about yourself, Ali.
Okay, so as I said, I'm Ali. I consider myself to be one of Joe's wife's best friends, and
that is true.
The wife of one of Joe's best friends. Hmm. I am a mother of two adult children, Joe, named after you, but female version, Joanna, and Alexander, known as Alex. I am in my day job a medic. I'm a hospital doctor who specialises in clinical genetics, and but I'm also somebody who has an interest in and a passion for spiritual formation, by which I mean the conscious choosing to have your life formed by something good. And in my case, I want my life formed by Jesus. I want to be Christ-like. And one of the tools that I have found really helpful in my quest is the Enneagram. I came across that many years ago, and did a lot of reading about it, and then you indeed arranged for us to do a weekend learning about it, and a couple of years later a follow-up weekend, and then the opportunity came up to learn to teach it and just learn a bit more about it. And so I took that opportunity up, managed to finish the course literally the month before lockdown in 2020.
Wow. Yeah.
So haven't had an awful lot of opportunity to teach it to big groups, but carry on talking about it to individuals and in small groups, just trying to help people understand themselves better. And so that's why I'm here, really.
It's an incredible tool. And I always say to people,
of all the books I've ever read about having a good marriage or understanding marriage or, you know, communication, the single biggest thing that has helped my marriage immeasurably is understanding Rachel's Enneagram type and my Enneagram type and how we just think so differently. And it's okay. Anyway, but we'll come on to that. But let's, to the point of the podcast, if people have never heard of the Enneagram, and we really want this to be an Enneagram 101, just give us a guide. What is the Enneagram? What actually is it?
Okay, so it's a very ancient tool that is essentially a description of the strategies that people use to cope with the world.
Okay.
To manage their interactions with the world and with other people. Yeah. And there's a lot of debate about where its origins are,
yeah.
But there's certainly some overlap with the teachings of the Desert Fathers. We yeah. also know that it was used by the ancient Sunni Muslims. Yeah. So it comes from I think it's a mysterious background, but certainly very ancient and more recently kind of taken up by psychologists and kind of developed a little to help other people understand each other. And they describe nine types, which is basically nine strategies for managing the world.
Yeah.
We are all of us capable of using any one of the nine.
Yeah.
And we all do so at various times in our lives, but we all have a default type.
Yeah.
That we go to, one that we fall back on. Essentially, the task when you're engaging with the Enneagram is to try and be really honest with yourself and recognize what your default type is. And in understanding that, you will hopefully understand yourself better.
Yeah.
But also in realizing the mechanism that you use by default, you kind of free yourself up to consciously try and use different mechanisms in areas where using your default one is not working.
And not helpful. That's brilliant. I mean, one of the things that I sort of just before we go into it all, I wanted to deal with is there's something about the look of it. If you haven't seen a picture of the Enneagram, it's sort of like a nine-pointed star. It's sort of, I don't know why, for some Christians, I know it conjures up sort of occultic symbols, and especially if they saw it on a floor lying with a few candles around, they would run a mile from it because it would look so dodgy. You know, are there any occultic things? Because I'm worried that people reject it on the basis of, well, this symbol looks like it could be, I don't know, the devil.
Yeah, I mean, when I teach the Enneagram, I actually usually start with, so you're right, you see a circle, and there are nine numbers written around the circle, and there are lines between the numbers, which do inevitably come up with a star shape. When I'm teaching the Enneagram, I usually start without the lines and then draw the lines in when they become relevant so that people understand that I don't think that there is a huge significance to the pattern that lines make. There are people out there that disagree with me, but I don't think it does. It's just that what the lines do is they connect you to another number. So my base Enneagram type is a one, but under stress, I am very likely to adapt the worst mechanisms of a four. And so there's a line that connects the one to the four and an arrow pointing down that line, which kind of goes, whoops, that's the way you slide under
when
stress.
When you're in trouble, yeah.
But there's also a line between one and seven.
Hallelujah.
Which is between us. And you would slide down towards one under stress.
Yeah.
But at my best, I'm going the other way up the line towards the seven.
Yeah.
So it's just the connection between those numbers and how you link. And they're called the arrows, but that's a little bit, you don't need to go into those today, but The lines on the diagram are just to show the directions in which you are likely to move. And there's really nothing occult about it, that the I don't think the Enneagram itself is spiritual. It's just a personality understanding tool.
Yeah.
And you can use it in any context.
Yeah.
Now, I was taught to teach it in a Christian context, in the context of trying to help create God-shaped people.
Yeah.
My teachers were Becky Widows and Margie Walker, and that was their passion, was to help people become God-shaped people. And that absolutely resonated with where I want to be. I want to be a God-shaped person.
Yeah.
And so that's why I was drawn to the way that they teach it. And that's why I teach it in that context. But the tool itself is neutral.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know.
That's good to say. And I have to say, one of the things I found helpful about it, unlike other personality types, I think we've both done Myers-Briggs and things in the past, but, you know, like, it's not about typing and saying, you're this number. There's so much complexity as there is in the human personality. There's so much room for the numbers either side of you. And like you say, what happens when you go under stress? And I think for me, I generally run away from the darker parts of my personality. I'm ashamed of them. I don't want to talk about them. But the Enneagram unashamedly talks about your weaknesses, doesn't it? It shows them.
Absolutely.
And I think to for me to discover and read that, I am, you know, I'm not alone. Inevitably, all that's great about my personality brings an equal and opposite shadow side. And it's really smart for me to understand it in order to temper it and to deal
exactly.
with it. So that's been the beauty of this whole thing for me.
And there is no good type and there's no bad type. We all have strengths, but those strengths are always the flip side of the shadow side. And it is about understanding both and celebrating what's good about your type, but also understanding what's not and working with that. And for those of you that again aren't familiar with the Enneagram, as I said, it's nine numbers written around a circle with the nine at the top and the one side of the nine and the eight the other, going round in a clockwise fashion. And you have a connection not just to the numbers at the end of your arrows, but you also have a connection to the numbers either side of you, where the terminology used is your wing numbers.
Yeah.
So that, just for those people that don't know what we're talking about here, by numbers either side, it's the ones either side of you as you go around the circle.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, shall we just launch into it? What I'd love you to do, if you're able to do it, I should say, Ali's sitting here with no notes, which I find extraordinary because she just retains this stuff in a way that I never can. But if you could give us just a rough guide to each of the numbers. So shall we start with one, or do we want to start with nine?
No, we can start with one.
Okay, well, let's just go one to
we
nine.
We can go one to nine for ease.
Let's do it. One is the one you... understand.
Yes. So ones are people who feel good about themselves if they feel they've got it right. That might be that they've made the right decision. It might be that they've got something factually right. Mm. It might be that they've behaved in the right manner. But there's something about a one that needs to get it right. In many Enneagram descriptions, the one is known as the perfectionist or the reformer, because if it's not right, ones want to put it right. Someone said ones are always about improving themselves, other people and the world. Therefore, ones have a tendency to judge, because, of course, it's always according to what the one thinks is the right thing to do. And therefore, we have a huge temptation to notice when people are not doing what we believe to be right and to judge them for it. The other issue with ones is that because the world is not right and there's lots of things that we feel need to be put right, there is an underlying current of anger from a one that is a reaction against the wrongness in the world around them. But of course, ones often perceive being angry as wrong. and therefore they don't, or they try not to display that anger or that irritation or that resentment. So they attempt to bury it, probably less successfully than they think they have. I remember when I was first exploring the Enneagram, the now famous conversation with my husband, when it dawned on me that I could be a one, asking my husband if I was full of repressed anger, to which his classic reply was, it's not that repressed.
Yes.
But true, very true, and I needed to hear it. So ones really are aware of their environment, and they're very keen to control the environment around them, and they don't like their environment impacting them very much. So it's very much I know what world should be, and I'm trying to make the world around me what it should be. And that's
when you say they tend to be judgmental, I mean the harshest voice, I think, is their internal voice towards themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, thank you for bringing that one up, because yes, the person that a one is most likely to judge, most likely to be angry with, most likely to be frustrated with, is themselves for not living up to the high ideals.
And they judge their own little mistakes. So, rims my observation.
So harshly. Yes.
I make a mistake, I laugh. Make a mistake,
and I'm
beat
really,
yourself up. Time.
Yes. We were talking about that when I accidentally put the wrong ingredient into something yesterday, and I was so annoyed with myself. And you were just like, so what? Doesn't matter. Absolutely. Yeah. But laughing at yourself is a real key for a one, because if you catch yourself being one-ish and you laugh at yourself, it kind of breaks the spell a bit, and then you can move on.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
So, having you around at that point was really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you for pointing out.
No, that's good. No, pleasure.
So twos.
Yeah.
Twos are people who feel good about themselves if they're being helpful, if they're being useful, if they're in a position where they're needed, in a position where they feel that people are relying on them.
Right.
That is where twos feel good about themselves. The problem with the twos is that they don't actually realise that their motivation for being helpful is a need to be needed. Right. So there is the sort of downside, if you like, of a two is pride, is this knowledge that they're a good person and that they're out there helping people in the world. And also the pride that they are the helpers and they don't need help. So twos are really, really good at understanding other people, at knowing what they need, at providing what they need when they need it. They are completely disastrous at identifying their own needs and meeting their own needs when required to do so. They put their own needs aside and serve other people. And this is such a part of their personality and such a part of their self-worth that when a two realizes that actually their serving of other people is not altruistic, it's a need to be needed, that can be really hard for a two to take on board and to understand, because it challenges their pride. Mm. And as I said, their pride is that flip side of a two.
Mm. I always think twos buy great presents.
Twos
they're
do
good
buy excellent
aren't
they? Presents.
Because they're
just
so focused on the
other person. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah. You do see a lot of twos in the caring professions. You come across twos in medicine and nursing a lot.
Yeah, interesting.
Because I'm a one, I have a two wing. I went into medicine because I wanted to help people.
Yeah.
And I think that was my two wing speaking. Mm. And they're lovely people. Everybody loves twos.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones that are in the kitchen helping you wash up. They're the people that stay behind to put the chairs away. You know, they are the hard workers. And also, I mean, in the church, twos are encouraged, especially women twos.
Yeah.
They're really, we like, We like women twos because they
it's almost help the model of what a woman should be. It's the model of
what a good Christian woman should be, yeah. Putting her own needs aside and serving the rest of the world. Yeah.
And like you said, there must be a point of realisation when they think, hang on a minute.
Yeah, there is. And when that happens, there's or when their efforts are not appreciated, there can be a real resentment and a real kind of flash of pain, really, when they feel that what their offer of help is being rejected,
all being or they're traffic. Being
pushed away, or they're not being appreciated. Mm. And it can really, really be a pain. I don't know if you ever watched the film 27 Dresses.
No.
So that it's somebody who's always the bridesmaid because she's always so helpful for other people. Okay. And they always want her to be the bridesmaid. And then there's this big crisis moment where she feels rejected and unappreciated. And there's a very unhelpful moment of confrontation with someone. And then, of course, she's beating herself up. But, of course, it's a romantic comedy. So the guy comes along and picks her up and makes it all right again. But if you're interested in twos, that's a good film to watch.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's the twos.
Right.
We're doing this really quickly.
Yeah,
folks.
I know.
So it's only an absolute sketch of these types.
Yeah.
But the threes are people who feel good about themselves if they're being successful.
Yeah.
So I would often say if a one and a three were playing a game of tennis, if the one lost but felt that they played a really good game of tennis, and it was just that the other person was better than them, they'd be fine with that. If the one lost because they played rubbish, they'd be really cross with themselves.
Yeah.
The three doesn't care how they play. Yeah. They don't even care if they play fair. They just want to win the game of tennis.
Yeah.
And all that matters is the winning.
Side note, I've played board games with threes and they're not ashamed to cheat.
No, they really aren't. What is important to a three is the winning. It's the success.
Yeah.
So threes are absolutely genius at image management.
Right.
They really know what success looks like and they fake it till they make it. Basically, they can put on whatever group of people they walk into. They seem to have an ability to A, know who's the power in the room and who they have to impress, but B, also to know how to behave in that room. What clothes to wear for any occasion, how sort of formal or matey to be. They just have that knack of knowing how to work a room. So for example, you might like to run, or you might like to swim, or you might be a good cyclist. A three will be an Iron Man. They will be the best swimmer, the best cyclist. Okay. You know, they will push themselves to extreme to be the best and to be successful at it.
Yeah.
But because image is so important to a three, they will do anything to preserve it. So as you say, they might cheat in a board game.
Right.
They might not play a fair game of tennis.
Yeah.
But then it can get more serious. So in a business setting, the three might cover up failure in order to make sure that it doesn't come down with them, or they might know that a venture's going to fail and they might leave the venture before it fails so that the failure is not on them, or they might find a scapegoat, or they might change the goalposts.
I certainly can't think of any politicians.
Comes to politicians, it can be outright barefaced lies.
Yeah.
And I remember a quote that I think it could have been a Mr. Johnson, but that said, it actually doesn't matter what you tell the public as long as you get their vote, and or words to that effect. And that would be a three's kind of possibly at their worst.
Modus operandi. Yeah.
At their worst, a three's
What's fabulous about being a three?
What's fabulous about being a three is that they are such efficient people.
Right.
First of all, they are really good leaders because they can read people so well.
Yeah.
They can have a vision and they can bring people with them.
Yeah.
And because they are so good at seeing what can be done, they can be really good visionaries for organizations. They can set a really great vision, and they can take people there. And they're really efficient users of time. And that is the really great side of being a three. And also, you know, if you want to be successful, a three has that passion. They have that ability to just work really hard until something's done.
And that is,
you know, that commitment to a cause that a three can bring is inspiring. And good threes are, as I said, amazing leaders.
And we should have said, perhaps, you know, that the idea is always to be the best of your personality, the redeemed three or the redeemed seven or one, or whatever it looks like.
A redeemed two will serve people from a place of immense love
and care. Exactly.
Once they can take themselves out of the equation,
sure.
they can still use their skills to read people and to know what they need. To serve them with genuine love. Great. So yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, look, we better move on. Let's come on to a four. I do a podcast with someone who matches this description
of a four.
Yeah.
So fours are people who feel good about themselves if they're being their own unique, authentic selves.
Yeah.
So fours are probably the widest variety of people that you will see will probably be within the four subtype.
Yeah.
So if you're, you know, and
yeah,
one of the dangers of categorizing people nine ways is for people to think that you think that there are only nine types of people in the world. I don't think there are. I think there are an infinite type of people.
Yeah,
but the range of personalities that you see in the four subtype is probably the widest because they're all trying to be their own unique.
Very
selves.
Unique, yeah.
And they also have a huge resistance to the Enneagram.
Yes.
Because they do not want to be pigeonholed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in fact, a certain person that we both know, when I first told him about the Enneagram, that was his first reaction. You can't pigeonhole me like that. Yeah. And then we were talking. I mean, fours have this incredible ability to see beauty in the world.
Yeah.
And they're also incredibly emotionally literate. They, you know, as a one, I the main emotion that I recognize in myself is anger. I do sometimes recognize gladness and sadness, but you know, glad, sad is probably my emotional range.
Right.
A four's emotional range is just incredible, and they understand their emotions, they can describe their emotions, they're really good at helping other people recognize emotions and deal with them. They're really creative people in the way that they approach the world. A lot of the arts, you know, theater, film, a lot of the greatest works of art in the world have come from fours.
From that sort of mindset.
That mindset and that ability to share their vision or the tale that they're trying to tell or the emotion that they're trying to describe, their ability to communicate that to other people in a creative way is incredible. And they tend to see beauty in places that other people don't. So, you know, they might see beauty in decay. For example, they might take a picture of a log that's being decayed by fungus and you know, say look at the, isn't this beautiful or they do seem to have a morbid fascination with death, it has to be said, which is interesting. A couple of problems for a four. One is that they tend to relate very, very strongly to their feelings, so they tend to think that they are their feelings and therefore to dissociate from their feelings is really hard. And then the other thing is that there is this problem with fours that they feel that they are lacking something, that they are fundamentally flawed, and they will look at other people and think they've got it right and I haven't. So it's a sort of Facebook disaster, you know, when they look at everybody else's perfect life displayed on Facebook.
Oh, do you mean they might come off Facebook,
they for might example? Do, because they can't cope with comparing it to their own flawed life.
Right, okay.
And so envy is the biggest issue with fools. They're envious of anyone they consider to be more beautiful, more talented, more creative than they are, which is another reason that Mr. Page didn't feel that the Enneagram was really for him, because, as he himself put it, there is nobody more beautiful, creative, or talented.
It's hard to imagine. I can't even imagine him saying
exactly. Sorry, Nick. Sorry, do you love you really?
We're laughing at you, not with you.
No. So that's the fours. They are this immensely talented, creative, but deeply troubled and well aware of their own flaws group. Fives. Fives are people who feel good about themselves if they have enough knowledge in any given situation to be competent.
Mm.
So that is their defense against the world, is knowledge. They want to make sure that they understand the situation thoroughly and that they have absolutely grasped all the facts before they launch in, or before they comment, or before they take part. They are often people who, in contrast to a four, find emotions difficult to articulate or to deal with, and are much more confident with facts and figures. And they are people who plan and to research. So, you know, if you need a new anything, ask a five before you buy, because they will do, you know, they will read up and find out what is the best, and they'll come back with 1,000 questions about what particular context you need it for. So do you need this one or that one?
And may I make an observation?
You may.
Because for some reason, and you'll probably explain why when you get sevens, most of my friends tend to be fives or people with strong five rings. What is it about fives and making coffee? If I want a cup of coffee, I make it. It's like 30 seconds. If a five makes a coffee, they have to flip and roast the beans, make sure the temperature's right, grind
it. Make sure they're ground to exactly, back to
exactly the right
amount. Right
grind, make sure the water is exactly the right temperature, you know, and like 3 days later, you've got a cup of coffee. What is that?
What is that? It is about that knowledge and expertise. It's about that identification of I am an expert coffee maker.
Yeah.
I know how to make a decent cup of coffee. But it is also about that connoisseurship. They actually really enjoy a decent cup of coffee. Whereas you might just be having it, frankly, for energy to move on to the next plan that you have in mind. And I might just be needing it to keep me awake. But they will really enjoy the experience of that coffee and really savour it and be aware of
the
different flavours in the coffee. And, you know, so there is a... there is that.
So they feel safe in the world, knowing lots of information, being experts.
And feeling that they can bring an expertise, that they can bring a knowledge to the world. And the thing about a five is that their knowledge is often very carefully acquired and something that they feel defines them. So they won't share it very easily. Or if they share it, they want it to be acknowledged that it's their knowledge, or they want to make sure that you are worthy of accepting the opinion that they have to give you. And carefully acquired titles like doctor or professor, you know, are really important to a five, because they are an acknowledgement of the time and effort that they've put into acquiring that knowledge. So in a meeting, You may find that a five says very little throughout the meeting, and then just as you're about to end the meeting and they've assimilated everything that someone else said, they'll come out with some really perceptive, really helpful insight into what you've been talking about. But they haven't said a word for the hour because they've just been taking it in, and also taking time to formulate their own opinion. So I am, as you know, because he's one of your best friends, yes. I am married to a farmer.
You are.
And one of the things that we've noted is that I am an external processor. I talk things through. I come to opinions by asking other people theirs, by discussing facts. Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Blah, blah, blah. My husband would never state an opinion until he's really, really thoroughly thought it through. And when he comes out with it, that is his well thought out, formulated opinion. Now, because I'm an external processor, I want to know how he got there. So I will immediately ask him questions about this immense bit of wisdom that he has just very generously shared with me. And then he, for a long time, felt that I was questioning his authority. I was undermining his wisdom. And it was through the Enneagram that we managed to understand what this tension was. And now I say to him, can I just say, I think that's great. I'm really am interested in what you've just said. It sounds, you know, really interesting, but I need to know how you got there. So can you explain your thinking to me? And he finds that much less threatening. That doesn't mean that I still don't disagree with him on occasion. But you know what I mean?
No, it's
just the approach is really helpful.
If you want to wind up a five, as I like to, just say, let's just sit down and talk about our feelings for a while.
They won't do that. The issue with a five is they are very reluctant to share of themselves at a personal, at an emotional level, or even of their knowledge if it's carefully acquired and they don't think you're worthy of it. One really interesting fact about a five is there won't be anybody in a five's life who knows everything about them. They have different compartments to their life.
That's interesting.
So there's work life, and then there's friends outside work, and then there's the wife. But you know, my five husband is about to retire, and he's planning a retirement deal with his work colleagues. And you know, I just jokingly teased him, going, "Am I going to be invited to this?" And it was like, "Oh, what? With work people, you know, it's like that's a different compartment of my life, and you don't belong there."
Well, we better move on because we're only at five, six.
Sorry,
no, let's get in six.
So six are people who feel good about themselves if they know where they stand and what's expected of them.
Right.
So sixes are people who understand hierarchy. They don't have to be at the top of the hierarchy, unlike the three, but they need to know where their place in the hierarchy is. They need to know who they are under and who's under them. They need to know the rules. They need to understand the rules, and then they'll stick to the rules. They're people who often have external people who they look to for authority, and therefore find it hard to trust their own gut instincts and their own inner authority. So they are people who are very, as I said, aware of what the rules are, and they are people who are underlying problem really is fear. I mean, we're all slightly fearful of things, but sixes go through life with a great deal of fear, and as I say, they manage that fear by knowing what's expected of them and knowing what the rules are. And then there are two types of sixes. There's the types that know what's expected of them and do that. So they're very loyal, law-abiding people. Or there are the sixes that deal with it completely the opposite way and go and rebel against what's expected of them and go out and fight their fear. So instead of managing it by obeying the law, they will deliberately disobey the law or ignore the guidelines and do something deliberately dangerous.
Okay,
so
that's interesting.
What sixes are really good at is knowing where danger lies. They're really good at spotting danger.
Okay.
And then they either avoid it or just hit it head on. And different sixes obviously have a tendency to be one or the other, but they can both be either in different situations in their lives. So you might have a six who's a really law-abiding citizen, but loves to do dangerous sports or something.
Okay.
So, so that, you know, you can have different people. And what they're really loyal people, great people to have, particularly the law-abiding sixes are great people to have in your organisation. But they're really, really good on health and safety.
Yeah, risk assessments.
Risk assessments, because they know where the danger lies.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I lost my own father before I knew anything about the Enneagram. But looking back, he was a man who was in the military. He wasn't a high military ranking officer. He was a mid-ranking officer. He was quite comfortable in that position. But he was a flight... He was a helicopter engineer, and he was their flight safety and accident investigator. And I just have a sneaking suspicion that he may have been a six.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Because it's perfect role for him. This understanding where the danger lies and pointing it out to other people, or knowing there must be a problem there, and then this dogged determination to find it.
Yeah,
which he absolutely had. Was this, I am going to find out what the problem was here to make sure this does not happen again. So this heightened awareness of danger and using mechanisms to control fear and to know that you're safe, a deep desire to be safe.
Great. Well, let's come on to the best number on the Enneagram, and without doubt the one everyone wants to be.
Well, I'm not quite sure I'll buy that there. Although what I will say is that for most of us, when we find our numbers, there's a deep desire for that number not to be our number.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's because we recognise the dark side, but we don't really want to admit it. And in fact, a friend, a mutual friend of ours, who I believe you've already interviewed on this podcast, Lacey Borgo, she says, if you haven't cried for 3 days, you haven't found your Enneagram number. Unless you're a seven. Because sevens are people who feel good about themselves if they're being happy, if they're being positive, if they are celebrating all that is good in life. And they too, I think, are really good at identifying problems and dangers around them. They're very, very observant people. But a sort of a seven's way of dealing with the stress of life is always to have a plan, a great plan. What we're going to do next. Yeah. So, you know, as you said at the beginning of this podcast, we have holidayed together. Well, we've holidayed every year for the last 28 years.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee that halfway through the second week of a holiday together, you will start to say, what are we doing next year? Because...
Yeah, but that's normal.
Before you can get to... Before you can before you can contemplate the sad end of one holiday, you have to have a plan to look forward to for the next one. And it's your it's your way of avoiding the pain of the end of a good, fun holiday. And the fun ending and you needing to go back to work is okay. I can cope with this bit of fun ending if I know when the next bit of fun's going to happen and I can look forward to it. And, you know, they say for sevens that more is more.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
There can never be enough cake. There can never be enough adventure.
Or cheese.
Cheese for you. Yeah, there can never be enough adventure. And it doesn't matter if the plans change.
No.
You're not wedded to your plans. You just need to have plans.
Yeah.
And the more plans, the better. And the problem for a seven is often narrowing it down, committing to one thing, one person, one plan, one job. I remember once one of your employers suggesting that you never get put in a meeting.
Yeah.
And it's that you're being pinned down and made to talk unbearable. About boring things is not where you're at.
It is unbearable.
At all. And this tendency to avoid pain,
yeah,
to not talk about pain, to not face up to pain. That is the big issue.
And of course, eventually it catches up with you.
Yeah.
And then there's a massive crisis.
Yes.
Because you haven't dealt with it.
Absolutely. And yes, so sevens are great. We all love sevens.
They're good in a room, aren't they?
You know when a seven's come into the room. The atmosphere of the room lightens. People love spending time with a seven. If you want to have fun, make friends with a seven.
Yeah.
And as a one, I'm not good at having fun.
Oh, you're one better now.
I'm much better now because whereas the rest of the world had to learn the celebration of discipline, as a one, that came very naturally to me. I had to learn the discipline of celebration.
Yeah.
And that, when I grasped that, was really helpful. Giving myself permission to stop and celebrate.
Yeah.
And not to worry that the work's not done first, because it never will be.
Yes.
And that's the sevens in my life that have taught me that. And so you are great at helping us have fun and lightening the mood and make plans for the future and be positive about the future. But in doing so, you're often running away from the past and the pain of the past and not wanting to confront that.
Yeah, well, I concur. Thank you. Thanks for being kind. Let's move swiftly on. Let's have some fun. To the eights.
Eights are people who feel good about themselves if they're being strong, if they are in control.
Yeah.
It has been said that eights will take control in a situation in order to avoid being controlled. They are people who don't have any tolerance, really, for shirkers and people swinging the lead, people putting it on, but they will fight to the death to protect someone who is genuinely vulnerable. They have a huge passion for justice. Talking of films, Erin Brockovich.
Yeah.
The way that I don't know who the lady is in real life, but the way that Julia Roberts portrays her in the film is absolute classic eight. She doesn't care what people think of her.
No.
She doesn't care. She dresses how she wants. She speaks how she wants. She will swear as part of normal vocabulary. But she is fighting to get justice for the people that have been screwed over by the water company.
Yeah.
And she uses other people in her search for justice.
Yeah.
So she'll flirt with the guy in the office so that he gives her the information that she needs.
Yeah.
She exploits her neighbour who fancies her and uses him as childcare so that she can have time. And that is very much the kind of flip side of an eight. It's this shamelessness. It's sometimes referred to as lust. But lust, not just in the sense of a hypersexualization of things. It's this objectifying and using of other people for your own purposes.
So again, eights make good leaders, don't they?
Eights make fantastic leaders.
Yeah, I think so.
And they're often very task orientated, and they can take people places where organisations, places where they wouldn't go without the ruthlessness, without the vision. Without the determination.
They seem to have quite thick skins. You see, I think seven, or I don't think, I think I'm not such a good leader because I think I worry about people liking me. I want everyone to like me, whereas an eight doesn't seem to care. Like, they know what's right and they're going to make sure it blooming happens.
That's true, and that's very true. But part of this persona of taking control rather than being controlled is in order to protect their own vulnerability. And they want to stay strong, so they takes a lot for an eight to admit vulnerability. In terms of great justice seekers of the world, eights are amazing people. And they can be quite challenging people to work with. But I think if you get under the skin of an eight and you understand what they're about, the other thing you need to know about an eight is they like conflict. They enjoy it. So an eight will be completely straight with you and will often actually push you further than you might want to be pushed. But if you stand up to them and come back to them in the same way, they will be fine. If they will be completely straight with you, It would want you to be completely straight with them.
Okay.
But they are very vulnerable underneath. And I think it's worth remembering that they're not people without feelings. That they are often the type that people find hardest to deal with, and therefore people are often rudest about.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, an eight can think, I've been working really hard for this organisation, that I've been doing these things to get us at the top of the tree, and all I get is abuse for it. And they don't see, perhaps, the reaction that their own strategy has caused for other people, but they do feel the criticism quite deeply. They are vulnerable, really.
So now we're going to go to nine, which is, on the Enneagram, is right back at the top of the circle. So tell us about the nine.
So the nines are people who feel good about themselves if all is calm and peaceful around them. They want there to be a lack of conflict in their lives. They actually fear conflict because relationships are really important to a nine. And your lovely wife, who is very dear to both of us, is a nine. She actually said to me, it's really hard for me to be in conflict because the word she used was shatter. I fear that if I raise a problem, that will shatter our relationship. And so I don't raise the problem. And they are people who again, they're lovely people to be around. Mm. Everybody loves nines. They have a brilliant ability to understand everybody else's point of view. They see where the problems are. They make excellent mediators. Yeah. But in doing so, they would more bury their own needs than bring up their own needs if they feel that that's going to cause a conflict.
Yeah.
And that's so much part of who they are that often they don't even know what their own needs are.
They've lost themselves somewhere. Yeah.
And they tend to merge with key people in their lives. So, you know, they will adopt your views on things because the relationship with you is so important. It's more important to them than their own view. And as you and I have both had to learn, is that you need to stop and ask and give a nine time to work out what they actually want. And I remember you as an example once you gave me that you said, I remember I thought we were making progress once. When I used to say to Rachel, what do you want? We'll go out for dinner for your birthday. Where do you want to go? And Rachel's inevitable answer would be, I don't mind.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't mind. But then you learn to say to her, we're going, you know, I'd like to take you out for your birthday. Would you like to go for an Indian or Chinese? And give her time to answer. And then she might come back and go, actually, I want to go to that new Italian. Yeah. But because you gave her choices, she could think, oh, I don't want that one. I don't want that one. What do I want? But if you just gave her the open choice,
she'd
just
panic. Much. Yeah.
Too much.
Yeah.
Don't know. Whatever you want, because I don't want to upset you on my birthday. So it is with nines, you have to realise that they need time and space to understand what they want and not take advantage of
that. No, exactly.
That they will go with whatever you want to do to keep the peace. So the great thing about nines is that they are so good at holding groups together and organisations together. But they, the downside is this, they would rather not act than rock the boat. So the word that the Enneagram uses for their downside is sloth. Yeah. Inaction, but it's not that they're not
they're lazy.
Busy people or lazy people. It's more an inability to do the right thing because they're scared of upsetting people.
And I've heard say that the nine's the hardest to type because they see themselves in every other number, and they're right at the top for a reason because they're so well balanced in a way that they see all the others.
And if you can't type yourself at all.
Yeah.
You may be a nine because you can see everything, or you may be a six and you don't trust your own yeah. thought, and you want yeah. someone else to tell you what yeah. you are. So it's yeah. very interesting. And I'm really aware, as I'm saying this, that this yeah. is such a surface sketch of these numbers.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there'll be people out there who are familiar with the Enneagram yeah. thinking, oh, she didn't mention that, because we've obviously got very yeah. limited time. But there's yeah. so much more.
There's lots to explore.
This is really just an introduction.
So thank you. I'm conscious time's going on, so I want to try and wrap things up. If people want to take things further, what would you say to them? What would be helpful? Are there any resources? But I mean, obviously there's a kind of simple online test, but you're a bit nervous about those,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, there are online tests and you can do them, and some people find them really helpful. My worry about online tests is that A, people tend to kind of think of them like an exam result.
Yeah.
So it comes out and it says you're this number, and therefore you assume you are that number.
And it might not be.
And it might not be. But secondly, those tests are often, I think, based on behaviour. And actually, it's motivation that's much more important. So a 9 and a 5 might both be really quiet in a meeting, but a 9 might not be saying anything because they don't want to rock the boat, and a 5 might not be saying anything because he's still formulating what he wants to say, but they both come across as quiet and not contributing to meetings very readily. So you need to think about motivation. I was taught Enneagram in the narrative tradition, so you hear about it and you react and you ask questions and you talk and you find your type that way. So I would push you towards any place where you're hearing stories, podcasts, for example, on the Enneagram, really helpful. Go on an Enneagram course and listen to other people, talk to other people, find your group that way. But there are also excellent books out there.
Such as?
Well, there's one sort of a beginner's introduction to the Enneagram, which is, we'll get Nick to put the link up, which is quite good fun. It gives lists and it does some cartoons of this is what everyone behaves like in a dinner party or whatever.
Yeah.
And that can make you laugh. And that's really good fun for trying to find out where each other in the family are. But there are some deeper books, and obviously my mind's just gone blank. But I will find some.
Yeah. And, well, Richard Rohr's done one.
And the good thing about Richard Rohr's one is that he has CDs of himself talking about each Enneagram type as part of the package. I think that's really helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap things up?
No, I think at the moment that's probably quite enough.
Okay. Well, if people want to get in touch with you, maybe they want to run a little group on the Enneagram, or maybe how would they do that?
Well, maybe a good idea would be to maybe get in touch with the podcast from there.
So send,
and you
send
and
it to
I
me.
Together have actually run some days.
We have for different numbers. Yeah. And we're going to do some more. Yeah, we're going to do the next one.
We should do that.
Yeah, we'll do that. So keep an eye out. We will send you more details. And if there is an appetite to do another day on the Enneagram, because this is just a brief thing, we could do an introductory day. Let us know. Send it into the normal email address, joe@midfaithcrisis.org, and we'd love to do that. But Dr. Alison Mayo, thank you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Reverend Davis.
Yes,
thank you.
It's been so lovely to chat to you. Let's go eat something.
So that was Ali talking about the Enneagram. Lots to feed on there. And I think we should do an episode talking about the Enneagram ourselves and how we encountered it and the difference it's made to us.
Yeah, no, that'd be really good. That'd be very funny, especially with you.
Yeah, really.
Your four like ways. Yes, it will.
Well, anyway, we will do that. But obviously not now because we're on holes.
Yes.
So thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting the podcast. And we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yes, indeed. Bless you all. Be kind to each other.